Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you have been riding shotgun with us for the last few months, you know, we have been absolutely obsessed with a very specific, very massive roadmap of the future.
We really have.
We are talking, of course, about the Read Multiplex series, You Have 5,000 Days. And today involves a pretty significant milestone.
It's a huge one. It feels like we've been on a long journey with this material from Brian Rumel. I mean, we've dissected the de-skilling of the workforce. We've analyzed the rise of the voice-first revolution.
And we spent a lot of time on that incredibly heavy, almost suffocating concept he calls the dark night of the soul.
Right. That moment where AI essentially just strips away the job part of your identity. It was pretty bleak stuff to get through.
It really was. And honestly, looking back at the last few discussions we've had on this, it's been a little dark. Enlightening, absolutely. Brian Rumel is nothing if not thorough.
Oh, unbelievably so.
But it has felt like watching a storm front move in. You know it's coming. You know it's going to change the landscape. But you don't necessarily want to be standing in the rain.
That is a very fair assessment. I think a lot of the early parts of the 5,000 days theory are, by necessity, about disruption. They are about the end of the world as we know it.
Right.
But today feels different. We are looking at part 13 of the series, and just the title alone, it gives me a little bit of hope. It's called The Gilded Age, Reclaiming Human Craft in an Age of Abundance.
The Gilded Age. I love the play on words there. It's not the Gilded Age of the Robber Barons. It's the Gilded Age.
Exactly. With you.
So set the scene for us. Where are we in this grand narrative that Rimmel's been building?
This is the pivot point. This is absolutely the turn. You have to remember that he structures this entire massive analysis around Joseph Campbell's hero's journey.
Okay, yeah.
We have had the call to adventure. We have crossed the threshold. And we have been in the belly of the whale. That's the dark night.
That's a good way to put it. The belly of the whale.
Today, we finally reach the return. The hero has survived the crisis, faced the dragon in this case, the existential threat of AI and automation, and is now coming back home. But he is not coming back empty-handed.
He's bringing something back.
He is bringing an elixir.
And spoiler alert for everyone listening, the elixir isn't a new iPhone. It's not some fancy brain implant. It's definitely not a universal basic income check from the government.
No, not at all. The elixir is a blueprint. And what I love about Rumel's work here and what makes it so different from so much futurism is that this isn't just theory. It's a practical architectural plan for society.
A new economic operating system.
That's the perfect term for it. He is arguing that the solution to a world where robots do all the drudgery isn't to just sit around and wait for a handout. It's a radical return to a system we abandoned over 150 years ago.
The Guild.
The Guild. Okay, so before we get into men in robes and secret handshakes, because that is definitely where my mind goes when I hear Guild.
Mine too, or like a video game or something. Exactly. World of Warcraft. Let's set the stage chronologically. Rumel is talking about a very specific time window here, right? He calls it the Abundance Interregnum.
Correct. We are looking at the window roughly from late 2025 to 2039. That is the 5,000 days.
Right.
The core thesis here, and this is the thing that truly bends your mind if you sit with it for a minute, is that AI and robotics are going to fundamentally break the link between human survival and human toil.
Say that again. That's a big statement.
For all of human history, you didn't work, you didn't eat, or you didn't have shelter. That was the deal.
The basic contract of what?
The basic contract. But in this coming decade, he argues, the cost of basic goods, food, shelter, generic manufactured items, is going to drop to near zero because the labor cost, the human component, drops to near zero.
Which, on the surface, sounds like an absolute utopia.
It does.
Until you ask the obvious question, which we have been asking for weeks now. If I don't have to work to eat, and a robot can do my Excel spreadsheets and my legal briefs better than I can? What am I for? What is the point of me?
And that is the existential wall. That's the crisis we talked about in The Dark Knight. And Rumel's answer in this installment of Read Multiplex is the guild economy.
Okay.
But I want to be really, really specific here because guild sounds like a Renaissance fair thing. It sounds quaint. He is describing a hard-nosed, practical architectural plan to restructure society.
Not a hobby club.
Not a hobby club. It's about shifting from an economy of scarcity, where we pay for things because they're hard to get to, an economy based on what he calls human rarity.
I love that term, human rarity. It just reframes everything. It implies that we become the scarce resource.
We are the scarce resource. Our creativity, our touch, our story, that's what's rare.
So to understand where we're going with this, Rummel actually drags us way back into the past, like deep past. We're going back to 1724.
Yes. And this is the part that's just so brilliant. It turns out the economic model that might just save us in 2035 looks suspiciously like Philadelphia before the Civil War.
Now, hold on. When I think of the 1700s, I think of dysentery, churning butter, no air conditioning.
Right. Not exactly a high-tech paradise.
I don't think economic superiority.
Yeah.
So why? Why is Brian Rommel pointing to this specific era as the blueprint for our hyper-advanced future?
He's looking at the structure. The decentralized nature of it. Between the early American settlements and roughly 1863, the economy operated on a completely different logic than what we have today.
What do you mean by a different logic?
Well, think about our system. Every transaction, more or less, flows through a central point. A bank. A credit card company.
Middleman.
Always a middleman. Back then, there was no Federal Reserve. There was no massive centralized banking system acting as the clearinghouse for every single transaction. It was a credit-based, reputation-based economy.
Okay, so that makes sense for, you know, trading chickens for shoes.
Mm-hmm.
But how did they build anything massive? I mean, we look at Independence Hall in Philadelphia. It's still standing. It's beautiful. You can't build that on IOUs and handshakes, can you?
Actually, you can. And they did. This is where the concept of the master craftsman comes in. Rommel does a brilliant job of breaking down what a master actually was in 1750.
This wasn't just a guy with a hammer and a saw.
Not even close.
Right.
A master builder was the architect, the engineer, the general contractor, and, this is the crucial part, the financier, all rolled into one person.
The financier. That seems like a stretch. How does a carpenter finance a state house?
He carried the risk. He would front the costs for materials and labor, and he'd carry that debt on his books. And to manage that risk and to ensure absolute top-tier quality, they organized.
Into guilds?
Into guilds. Rommel focuses heavily on the Carpenters Company of Philadelphia, which was established in 1724.
Okay.
They created something that is the technical unlocking mechanism for this whole theory. If you can understand this one document, you understand the future guild. It was called the Rule Book, or the Book of Prices.
The Book of Prices. Okay. Let's unpack this. Because today, if I hire a contractor to redo my kitchen, I'm usually paying for materials plus labor, you know, hours worked.
Right. X dollars per hour.
Or maybe a fixed mid, where I secretly suspect they're cutting corners to make their margin.
Right. Time is money. That is a classic industrial age concept. It assumes that the value is in the clock, that an hour of your time is worth a set amount.
Which seems logical.
It does now, but the guilds rejected that entirely. They used something called unit pricing.
Explain the difference for us. This feels important.
It is the absolute key. Unit pricing means they charge by the output, not the input.
Okay.
So if you were laying flooring, the Book of Prices had a set rate for a square, which was a defined unit, 100 square feet, or for a linear foot of wainscoting. It didn't matter if it took you 2 days because you were meticulous, or 2 weeks because you were slow, or 2 hours because you were a genius.
The price was the price.
The price was the price for that unit of finished quality work.
That actually changes the incentive structure completely, doesn't it?
Completely. In an hourly model, the incentive for the worker can be to drag the work out to get paid more.
Or get it done as fast as possible, quality be damned.
Exactly. Or, if it's a fixed bid, the boss pushes you to rush, use cheap glue, and hide the mistakes behind the drywall to widen the profit margin. We've all seen that.
We have all lived that.
In the guild model, the incentive is mastery. You want to do it efficiently, sure, but you have to meet the standard to get paid for that unit.
Yeah.
There is no benefit to cutting corners because you simply won't get paid.
Right. But who sets the standard? That's the big question. If I lay a crappy floor really quickly, do I still get the unit price? Who is the referee who says this is good enough?
That is the genius of the system. And this is the part I found most fascinating in Rommel's research. They had a role. They had measurers.
Measurers?
Yes. These were sworn members of the guild. They had to be highly experienced, usually with decades of work under their belts. They were the most respected masters.
What did they do?
When a job was done, the master builder didn't just send an invoice. Two measurers would go to the site. They would physically measure the work. They would check the joinery. They would check the plumb lines against the specifications in the rule book, and they would determine the final value.
So no haveling. I can't argue, hey, I tried really hard, or my material costs went up unexpectedly.
No haggling. It was equitable. It was a three-way protection system. It protected the client from being overcharged. It protected the craftsman from being underpaid. And it protected the reputation of the entire guild. The price was the price.
And this rule book, you said it was the key.
Yes, and it was semi-secret.
Ah, okay. Here comes the secret society aspect. I knew it was coming.
It wasn't secret because they were, you know, hiding a conspiracy to take over the world. It was intellectual property. It was the collective knowledge and standards of the guild built over decades.
And you had to earn the right to access it.
You had to. Brian Rommel shares this absolutely great anecdote in the text about Thomas Jefferson. Now, you have to think about Jefferson. This wasn't just a politician. He was a brilliant architect. He designed Monticello. He designed the Virginia State Capitol. He was a serious player.
Right. If anyone deserves access to the architectural secrets of the day, it's Jefferson.
You'd think so. Well, in 1817, Jefferson basically knocks on the door of the Carpenter's Company and asks to see a copy of their rule book. He wants to know their pricing standards, their methods.
And they say.
They politely told the former president of the United States to get lost.
Denied. They denied Thomas Jefferson.
Flat out, because he wasn't a member. That knowledge, the standard of value, belonged to the collective. It ensured that only people who had put in the work, who had gone through the 7-year apprenticeship.
7 years.
Only they could operate in that market. It was a quality control mechanism that was incredibly strict.
We don't do anything for 7 years anymore. We barely do anything for 7 months. A university degree is 4.
And that's the tragedy Rommel is pointing out. That apprenticeship wasn't just learning to saw a straight line or mix mortar. It was learning the ethics of the trade. It was learning to live in a web of mutual obligation.
What do you mean by that?
You literally lived with the master. You ate at his table. You became part of his family. You learned how to be a member of the community, not just an employee.
Let's talk about that obligation. Mm-hmm. Because you mentioned earlier that there wasn't a lot of cash floating around in 1750. So if I'm a carpenter and I build a barn for a farmer, how do I actually get paid if there's no national currency in my pocket?
You get credit, and I don't mean a credit card swipe. I mean a literal entry in a ledger book. Farmer John owes me for one barn framing. And that debt might sit there on the books for 5 years.
5 years. That requires a massive amount of trust. Our entire economy would collapse if payments took 5 years.
It requires reputation. That's the currency. Eventually, Farmer John pays you back in pork or corn, or maybe he helps you clear a field next spring, or maybe he gives you lumber from his woodlot for your next project.
Or you trade the debt itself.
Exactly. You could take that debt from Farmer John and use it to pay the blacksmith for new tools. It was a relational economy. If you were a jerk, or if you did bad work, or if you stiffed someone, you were exiled from the economy because nobody would trade with you. Your name was your bond, your reputation was everything.
So we have this historical baseline. High trust, high skill, unit pricing, decentralized credit. It sounds pretty great, actually. But then, 1863 happens. What went wrong?
It's not that it went wrong exactly. The Civil War required centralization. The North needed to fund a massive, modern war machine. You can't fund a war on barter and local ledgers.
You need cash.
You need cash. So the government passed the National Banking Acts. They centralized the currency, created the greenback, and established the national banking system we more or less have today. And slowly, over decades, that industrial model of labor took over.
We stopped being makers and started being employees.
We traded mastery for a wage. And Rommel isn't saying that was bad per se. It built the 20th century. It built the skyscrapers and the highways and put a car in every garage.
It was necessary for that era.
Exactly. It was necessary for scaling the industrial age. But Rommel's core argument in this Gilded Age deep dive is that the industrial model is now obsolete. The industrial model is an operating system for scarcity. It's for rationing resources. But we are entering the abundance interregnum.
So let's pivot. Let's get into the return. Why do we go back to guilds in 2030? If a robot can 3D print a house, why do I need a guildmaster? It seems totally counterintuitive to go back to a system from 300 years ago when we have super intelligent AI.
Because of one word. Value. This is the hardest concept to really grasp, and Brian Rommel spends a lot of time on it. When AI drives the cost of mass production to near zero, when a robot can print a perfect plastic chair for a penny or generate a perfect legal contract for free, that chair has no economic value.
It has utility, you can sit in it.
It has utility, but it has no trade value. If you can get one for free, why would you pay for it?
Right. If everyone have it, nobody pays for it. Basic supply and demand.
Exactly. So traditional cash, which is a tool designed to ration scarce resources, becomes kind of irrelevant. Marginal is the word Rommel uses. Cash becomes a vestige of a bygone era of scarcity.
So when all the material necessities are cheap, what becomes expensive? What becomes the new scarcity?
Us. Humans. The things the robot can't do.
The human unique stuff.
Precisely. Human unique labor. The intuitive touch. The relational depth. The connection. The story. Rommel's insight is that we aren't going back to poverty. We are using this old guild structure to manage plenty. We're building a new social operating system around the things that actually matter when survival is guaranteed.
Okay, so paint the picture for me. How does this actually work? It's 2032. I'm not joining a union. I'm not punching a clock. What am I doing?
It's much more grassroots than that. Rommel describes it as voluntary and local. So imagine 6 or 7 friends gathering in a living room or a local makerspace. They trust each other. They have complementary skills. They decide to form a guild.
Okay.
Como mamá, siempre quiero lo mejor para mi familia. Por eso quiero lo mejor en mi cocina. Y eso significa solo huevos Eggland's Best. No importa cómo los cocines, siempre saben frescos y deliciosos. Y tienen más vitaminas D y E y el doble de omega 3 que los huevos regulares. Entonces, ¿por qué conformarte con menos cuando puedes tener lo mejor? Eggland's Best. Mejor sabor, mejor nutrición, mejores huevos.
Okay. Step 1. Get 6 friends you trust. That might be the hardest part.
Huh, true. Step 2. They draft the new rulebook. It's modeled directly on that 1786 original from Philadelphia.
But instead of pricing floorboards,
they define their own unique units of value. And this is where it gets incredibly creative. It's not just square feet of wood. For a storytelling guild, it could be emotional depth hours. For a software guild, it might be complexity units for a piece of code. For a chef, sensory innovation units.
You define what you value as a group.
You define your own economy. And then you have the ledger. Are we talking blockchain?
Probably. Seems like a natural fit.
Rommel suggests blockchain is the logical tool for transparency, but he's clear that the tech isn't the point. The point is the transparency. Everyone in the guild sees the ledger. You know exactly who has contributed what and who owes what. There are no secrets.
And there's a ritual to it. I like this part.
The monthly ritual. The pricing committee meets. Just like the measurers of old, they review the work done by members that month. They assign credits based on the rule book that they all agreed to. And then payment is instant. Credits just appear in your personal account on the guild ledger.
Rommel gives a really specific, concrete example in the text, Sarah the Potter, in the year 2032. Mm-hmm. I think this really helps ground it. Can we walk through her day?
Yes. This is the day in the life of the future economy, and it's a great illustration. So Sarah makes a set of 12 dinner plates.
Now, we have to remember that in 2032, a robot in a factory could probably 3D print 10,000 plates in an hour that look mathematically perfect.
Absolutely. But Sarah doesn't mass produce. She uses a specific glaze that was inspired by her grandmother's recipe. There's a story, there's soul in the object. She hand turns them, so each one is slightly unique.
This is the human rarity part.
This is it. So the guild's pricing committee visits her studio. They don't just count the plates, they measure the surface area, they assess the complexity of the glaze, they consider the story, and they award her, let's say, 240 guild points.
Right. And here is the magic of the direct exchange. She doesn't take those points to Bank of America and cash them out.
No need. She turns around and instantly spends 80 of those points with another guild member, a guy down the street who hand-forged some beautiful kitchen knives.
Okay.
Then she spends 60 points on a musician in her guild to come play live music at her daughter's birthday party next month.
And the rest.
She banks the rest. She's saving up for a big project, a cabin renovation, that another member of the guild, a master carpenter, is going to do for her.
And the key takeaway here is no invoices, no waiting 30 days for payment, no transaction fees, no middleman skimming 3% off the top.
Just a direct exchange of value between people who know and trust each other. And because it's local and reputation-based, the trust is inherent. You know Sarah, you know the guy who made the knives. You aren't trusting a credit score algorithm from a faceless corporation. You're trusting the relationship.
This sounds idyllic, but Rommel gets very specific about how this applies across all of society. He lists 10 specific examples of future guilds. I think we should walk through these because they really show the breadth of this vision. It's not just for potters and carpenters.
Absolutely not. It covers the full spectrum of human activity. He breaks them into a few groups. Let's look at the physical crafts first.
Okay, so example number one, custom home construction.
This is the direct descendant of the 1724 carpenters. In the future, as he lays it out, an AI will do all the heavy lifting on the structural engineering. It will ensure the house doesn't fall down. It will optimize the material usage down to the last millimeter.
The machine handles the how.
Right. But the guildmaster adds the soul. The carved details on the mantelpiece, the ergonomic flow of the kitchen that fits a specific family's lifestyle, the way the window perfectly frames the morning sun. You aren't paying for the drywall and the 2x4s. You're paying for the artistry. That's what's valuable.
And the payment might be in guild credits, or the text mentions it might be in heirlooms. Trading an old family grand piano for a new handcrafted staircase, it's a very intimate economy.
It really is. Then there's number two, bespoke furniture. Again, the focus is on the object becoming an heirloom. An oak table isn't priced by how many hours it cooked to make. It's priced by complexity units.
So you look at the joinery.
Exactly. What kind of joinery is it? Is it a complex dovetail, a mortise and tenon? The furniture becomes a store of value, not a disposable commodity like we have today with fast furniture from a big box store.
That makes so much sense. I also love example number nine in this group, small-scale farming.
This is so crucial. AI can and will optimize crop yields on mega farms. It can give you a perfect calorie-dense red round tomato that can ship 3,000 miles.
But it tastes like cardboard.
It tastes like water. But the farmers in these guilds are cultivating unique heirloom varietals that an AI can't originate. They trade based on what Rommel calls flavor profile units.
Flavor profile units. That is such a cool concept. You're not buying a pound of tomatoes. You're buying a specific sensory experience, the taste of summer from your childhood.
Exactly. You're buying a story. Now, look at the second group he outlines, the service and social crafts. This is where the guild model expands beyond the purely physical.
Example number four, culinary and fermentation.
This is the farmer's market on steroids. Here, the valuation is on sensory innovation. You go to a guild dinner. The ingredients are hyper-local from the farming guild. The recipes are generational, passed down through families. You aren't just eating, you are participating in a story.
And how do you pay?
You might pay the chef with unique spices you grew yourself, or with guild credits you earn from your own craft. It returns dining to a communal ritual rather than just fueling up your body.
And then there's example number six, community dispute resolution. This one struck me as really profound because our current legal system is, well, it's a nightmare.
It is. It's adversarial by design. It's incredibly expensive. It's designed to produce a winner and a loser, which often fractures communities.
Right.
In the guild economy, he envisions a guild of elders or trained mediators. Their goal isn't winning, it's achieving relational harmony.
And they are paid in credits for the facilitation effort.
It's about healing the community rather than dividing it. Imagine resolving a fence dispute with your neighbor, not by suing them for $50,000, but by having a respected mediator facilitate a solution where everyone saves face and you can still have a barbecue together next weekend.
That's a world I'd like to live in. Yeah. And it's similar for example seven, holistic healing and elder care.
This is a perfect human AI partnership. The AI does the diagnostics. A machine can analyze your blood work or your MRI scan better than any human doctor. It can tell you what is wrong.
But the human provides the care.
The human does the empathic listening. They provide the touch. They hold the hand. They help you navigate the fear and the uncertainty. That's the valuable part.
And the text specifically mentions that widows and orphans are automatically supported in this system. It's built into the code of the guild just like it was in 1724.
It's a fundamental part of the charter. Moving to the arts and innovation group. Example three is mentorship. Rommel talks about reviving the seven-year apprenticeship, but here, the journeymen, the teachers, are paid for teaching intuitive techniques.
You give that amazing example of metal tempering by breath.
Right, and that sounds esoteric, but think about it. There are things a master blacksmith knows or a glassblower knows about the material that cannot be captured in data. It's a feeling, it's a rhythm, it's a sense, and AI literally cannot replicate that because it doesn't have a body, it doesn't have breath.
So teaching that human nuance becomes high-value work.
Incredibly high-value. Then there's example five, live performance.
This one is about reaction, about being present.
Exactly. An AI can play a piece of music perfectly. It can generate a flawless symphony. But can it improvise based on the specific, unique energy of the room on a Tuesday night? Can it feel the tension in the crowd and break it with a perfectly timed joke or a surprising chord change?
No. That's pure human connection.
That's emotional depth, and that's what the guild prices. Then you have example 8, symbiotic innovation. This is the ultimate partnership. Humans provide the why, the purpose, the crazy idea, the spark of genius. The AI provides the how. It does the complex modeling, the calculations, the brute force work.
And finally, he wraps it all with the safety net. Example 10, crisis mutual aid.
This brings it full circle back to the 1700s. If your house burns down or you get a serious illness and can't work, the guild covers you.
Not a faceless insurance company that makes you fill out 100 pages of forms and then tries to find a loophole to deny your claim to save money.
It's immediate. It's drawn from the entrance fees and the collective investments of the guild itself. There's no bureaucracy. It's just neighbors helping neighbors because they have a transparent ledger of mutual obligation. It's insurance, but it's human insurance.
Now, I can hear some of our listeners screaming at their speakers right now. This sounds like a commune. This sounds like socialism. Are we all going to wear gray jumpsuits and share everything?
Right. It's an easy conclusion to jump to.
But Brian Rommel is very, very explicit in the text. This is not a socialist utopia.
He is incredibly firm on this point. In fact, to make the point as strongly as possible, he explicitly invokes Ayn Rand.
Which is about as far from socialism as you can get. He calls it the purest form of capitalism.
And the distinction is vital. Socialism, or collectivism, generally involves forced redistribution, a central authority, the state taking from one person to give to another, whether they want to or not.
This is different.
Rommel argues the guild system is based entirely on voluntary association. You choose to join. You choose to trade. You can leave anytime you want. Nobody is forcing you to do anything.
And it honors rational self-interest.
That's the objectivist angle. The craftsman offers their skill not because they are forced by some committee to serve the community, but because they enjoy the act of creation and they want to trade that creation for other valuable things.
They want the best knives, so they make the best plates to trade for them.
Exactly. It's intensely meritocratic. If you make bad plates, nobody trades with you. You fail. There is no tenure in the guild. Your reputation is earned every single day.
Rommel also contrasts this very sharply with UBI, Universal Basic Income. A lot of futurists say, well, the robots take the jobs, the government sends everyone a check, and we all sit around playing video games. Rommel hates that idea.
He argues, and I think this is a really powerful psychological insight, that UBI fails because it separates reward from effort. And for human beings, that is a disaster.
It strips away dignity.
It strips away dignity. We need to feel that our effort produces our reward, that our contribution matters. That link is essential for mental health, for self-worth.
And the guild system keeps that link.
It preserves that link perfectly. You don't get credits for breathing. You get credits for mastery. You get credits for contributing something unique and valuable that other people want.
That leads us perfectly into the final section of our deep dive today, the psychological return. Because this whole series, You Have 5,000 Days, it hasn't just been about economics or technology. It's been about the soul.
Deeply. The dark night of the soul, which we discussed in our previous sessions, was fundamentally a crisis of identity. The question was, if I'm not my job, who am I? If a robot can write my reports, do I even matter?
And the guild is the answer to that identity crisis.
It is. The shift is profound. You move from an identity based on employment to one based on vocation, from jobs to mastery.
So my identity isn't, I am a mid-level manager at Corbex.
No. Your identity is, I am the one who makes the impossible joints, or I am the storyteller who can make a room of adults weep, or I am the one who bakes the bread that reminds everyone of their grandmother.
It's about being known, known for something real.
Being known and being needed. Rommel talks about the joy of direct exchange. There is a profound emotional weight, a real psychic reward, to handing someone a custom cabinet you built and seeing their eyes light up.
You can't get that from a direct deposit slip.
You cannot get that from a direct deposit slip. You cannot get it from a performance review or a bonus check. That is a human-to-human transaction of gratitude and value.
He uses the word eudaimonia. Can you break that down?
It's Aristotle's concept. It's often translated simply as happiness, but that's too weak. It really means human flourishing. It means exercising your highest human capacities in service to others and to yourself. It's the feeling of being fully alive and actualized.
And this guild economy is designed to maximize that.
It's designed to maximize eudaimonia, not GDP, not quarterly earnings, human flourishing.
So we move from what he calls scarcity anxiety, where we are always worried about not having enough, hoarding our resources, competing with our neighbors.
So abundance gratitude to realizing we have enough of the material things, and now we can focus on building lives rich with meaning through those micro exchanges.
Fixing a chair for a loaf of homemade bread.
It sounds small. It sounds maybe even primitive to our modern hyperscale ears. But Rommel's argument is that a life is built out of those moments. That is where meaning resides.
We realized the meaning was never in the machine. It was never in the efficiency. It was always in the human touch.
Always.
So to recap this whole amazing idea, we have the blueprint from 1724. We have the new tools, the AI, and the coming abundance. And we have the destination, the guild. The guild economy is the elixir we bring back from this 5,000-day journey.
It is. And the most exciting part for me is the call to action. Rommel doesn't say, wait for the government to pass a guild act in 2035.
No. He says, start now.
Don't wait for 2039. He says, gather six friends. Today, draft a rule book for yourselves. Experiment with unit pricing. Start trading your skills and your favors using a shared ledger, not cash. Create the lifeboat before the ship sinks.
Paint boldly. That's the phrase he uses. The next 5,000 days are the canvas.
It's a beautiful, empowering sentiment. True wealth has always been one another. The machines just clear away all the clutter so we can finally see that clearly again.
I have to say, looking back at this entire series from Reed Multiplex, Brian Rommel has really mapped out something extraordinary here. It's not just doom and gloom about robots taking over. It's a hopeful, practical, and deeply human vision of the future.
It absolutely is. It's a roadmap that honors the wisdom of the past to build a future that is actually worth living in. It's been a privilege to analyze it. And honestly, I think this Gilded Age concept is the most important part of the entire series. It turns the existential threat of AI into an opportunity for a true human renaissance.
And that is a wrap on our deep dive into the Gilded Age. We want to thank you for listening, and we want to leave you with one final thought to mull over.
Go for it.
If your job disappeared tomorrow, if the corporate title vanished, if the paycheck stopped coming, what is the one thing you could make or do that is so unique, so you, that a neighbor would trade their most precious heirloom just to have it?
That's the question. Finding that is the work of the next 5,000 days.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you in the next deep dive.
Take care.